On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we talk about Kyle Tucker being benched, the struggles he's been dealing with over the last month plus with the Chicago Cubs, what has happened to someone that we thought was one of the best players in baseball. Then we welcome in Brian Anderson, broadcaster for the Milwaukee Brewers, talk about the magical Milwaukee season, go around the league, talk about some other news and notes from the last couple of days before we say goodbye. All that and more on this episode of Baseball Barbacast.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only podcast in the world that wants to get benched. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. My legs are tired. Don't play me.
Dog days of summer, please. We've been podcasting so much lately. I know we both just went on vacation, but yeah, do you think a major leaguer has ever come in and just be like, nah. Yes. I know there's some discourse involving some players right now not wanting to play. We're not going to talk too much about Ketel Marte, but we're going to talk about someone who probably does want to play, but isn't playing very well right now. And so his manager said, let's take a break. But Jake, before we get to Kyle Tucker and the Cubs and our special guest, Brian Anderson, the Brewers broadcaster, I understand we have some important housekeeping to take care of.
Yeah, this is pretty rad, dude. Little plug piece. So we've now been doing the podcast Yahoo Sports for a year and a half. Just an absolutely undeniable, enjoyable experience being here at Yahoo. And some big news on the Yahoo front is that you can now watch Baseball Barbacast on the Yahoo Sports Network, the first ever streaming TV channel from Yahoo. So you know, like when you turn on your TV and there's like TV on your TV right away and you don't have cable, like we're going to be on there. It's pretty sweet. You can also stream it live 24/7 on the yahoosports.tv. Catch all your shows across the network on your phone, on your browser, and then on your TV. Look, Mom, I'm on TV.
Seems cool. More ways to watch Baseball Barbacast. Sounds like a good thing, assuming you're listening and enjoying and watching and whatnot. But also,
if you hate
more
this,
opportunities for you to accidentally watch Baseball Barbacast, which is pretty exciting.
That's true. And if you hate us, this is bad news. Like, haters out there that are listening to the pod, like, tremble in your boots.
Yeah, my condolences to you. All right, Jake, we have mucho baseball to talk about. As always, let's get to our opener.
This is not how the Kyle Tucker experience on the north side of Chicago was supposed to go. The Cubs acquired Tucker over the winter for three players, all of whom had quite a number of years of control left. That package headlined by now rookie outfielder Cam Smith. And Tucker, who is a free agent this upcoming offseason, the thought was this is going to be a diet Juan Soto situation. A great player for 1 year, playing in a big market, helping the Cubs to the playoffs before hitting free agency and getting a record deal. And for the first 2 months of the relationship, it was nothing but butterflies, rainbows, and long balls as Tucker raced out to an incredible start, propelling what was, for much of the spring, the best offense in baseball. Now, the summer has not been kind to Tucker and the Cubs, and they have tumbled far down the standings behind the first place Milwaukee Brewers. And meanwhile, Tucker's offensive production has absolutely cratered. Tucker has the third lowest slugging percentage in baseball since the All-Star break, better than only, hilariously, Cam Smith, who he was traded for, and light-hitting Braves shortstop Nick Allen. It all came to a head over the weekend at the beginning of this week when Tucker was booed by the Wrigley Field faithful for yet another rollover to the right side. And then on Monday during a day game against the Brewers, after popping out, he slammed his helmet into the turf and was benched for game two. So here we are, the morning of Wednesday, August 20th. The Cubs won both ends of a doubleheader yesterday against the Brewers. But the main story in Cubby Land, unfortunately, is what has happened to Kyle Tucker.
Yeah. And this is, as we said, this is a pretty shocking plummet into depths that we did not know Kyle Tucker could ever access. And we can do a little bit of speculation about how we got here as to how a hitter with this kind of track record, who was having an awesome season, right? I mean, the first couple months, it was like, yes, this was the whole point. We got Kyle Tucker to be this. We should just extend him now. Let's give him an extension offer he can't refuse so that he doesn't get to free agency and command $400 and $500 million, whatever. And now you've got Cubs fans booing him who are like, screw it, we don't need Kyle Tucker. And you know, that's not what they're saying. But the point is, you have an offense that is not entirely reliant on Kyle Tucker, but Kyle Tucker has become this headline of a lineup that has regressed to a degree that I did not envision. Sure, maybe they weren't going to be scoring 6-7 runs a game like they were for big stretches earlier in the year, but they've been the worst, not just bad for what they were relative to season, worst offense in baseball in August. At least they were before the doubleheader yesterday. Maybe they've climbed to 29th or 28th by WRC+. Of course, that has coincided with the Brewers having this epic run. That is horribly poor timing. But for Kyle Tucker individually, the fact that he has been this bad, you mentioned that stat about the slugging percentage, the fact that he is now not, I mean, you can look at it that way. You can make it even more simple. The guy hasn't homered in over a month. He has one home run since the start of July. Those guys that are behind him or that are, you know, in that fun fact about slugging percentage, Nick Allen has zero home runs this season. Nick Allen is at the top of the why haven't you homered yet leaderboard. Cam Smith, a rookie, of course, still making serious adjustments, playing in the big leagues for the first time. Kyle Tucker, we've just never seen him struggle like this. And this benching, while did come after he maybe didn't run a ball out and is, you know, showing frustration, also seems to be very clearly like an opportunity for the Cubs to be like, hey, dude, like, you need to take a step back. We have this prospect in Owen Casey that we've been looking for a lane to get him playing time anyway. We can talk about Owen Casey in a second. This seems to be a combination of you need to take a step back here, because if we are going to have any chance of being a very relevant team into October, we need Kyle Tucker at our best. And I don't know how they're going to fix that in one day or 2 days off, but there seems to be something that needs to change, because whatever has been happening with him recently is not even close to good enough.
A spiral like this, in my opinion, usually is a mechanical issue that balloons into a mental one, right? Into an emotional situation. Because Kyle Tucker has simply never been this bad for this long in his entire life. And so I would imagine that whether there's some underlying injury or there was a unfortunate, you know, mechanical leakage, right? Where he started doing something with a swing that wasn't optimal. He then got bad for long enough that it was like, oh my God, I'm bad. I have literally never been bad at this thing that defines my life. Add to that, him having the expectations of being in Chicago, which, I mean, amazing player in Houston, was never his team. At any point was the expectation like, Kyle Tucker needs to carry us. No, not even remotely close, right? He was below Correa, below Altuve, below Bregman, below Yordan. And so it's like, in Chicago, it's Kyle Tucker has to produce, he has to perform. And I'm not saying that that's gotten to him or it hasn't gotten to him, but it is certainly a dynamic
here. He was doing it, though.
It's been at play.
I mean, that's the thing. It was happening. Yeah. You know, those first 2 months, that was what was made him so interesting, regardless of the free agency. It's what you just laid out, is that responsibility, even in a lineup with other good hitters. And of course, when PCA was also performing like an MVP, like there were this lineup, there were other guys also doing it. So maybe it made it easier. Now, as he's gone down, a lot of the other hitters have also gone down. So maybe that has elevated the pressure on him. But you just look at the stats and you look at the exit velocity, the launch angle, like everything is worse. Like, it's not just always getting unlucky. The process stuff is also terrible. That tells me, okay, something has gone really wrong here. Is he battling an injury? Is he bad? Has his mechanics gotten so far out of whack? And then at some point, as you mentioned, it's just like, well, this isn't, because when you have hitters this good, you're not saying, okay, you're going to go bat eighth. You know, there's other hitters where it's like, all right, we'll move him down and we'll deal with it. Like, we just had this conversation literally with Mookie, but about Mookie also, where it's okay, it's Mookie Betts. I'm not going to have him batting eighth. he's still going to bat at the top. And I can understand people being like, no, he looks so bad. He doesn't deserve to be batting up there. Same thing with Kyle Tucker. They're not going to move him that far down in the order. But now he's been so bad that he's been actively hurting the Cubs offense when you're hitting that many times.
So I have an idea for the next collective bargaining agreement. It's called the Cancun Clause. All right. It feels that during seasons, it's a long season, and I'm not trying to like turn the players into victims. They're making more money than you and I will ever see. Kyle Tucker is about to be able to, you know, purchase like a whole county if he wishes. He's still going to get big paid this winter. But over the course of a season, the mental exhaustion that comes with playing every day and having only a two-day break if you go to the All-Star game. And the other thing that's, I think, underrated for baseball players is their off days. They still have to go to work. You know, like if I take a day off, I'm not talking to you. Like, I'm not opening my laptop. Like, if they're, you're out of the lineup. I'm talking like not an off day. You got a day off. Like,
yes.
They have to come in. They still do media. They still hit. They still work out.
That's true.
They're still till 10:30. Yep. And like, that gets tiring and mentally exhausting. And so I want the Cancun Clause. All right. Once a year, each team can put a player on the Cancun list where they get to go to the beach in Mexico and sit there for 3 days and not think about baseball and completely mentally decompress. I think closers need this more than anyone. Mm-hmm. This was the case with Clay Holmes, it felt like, when he was a Yankees closer. It was like, just get him 3 days on the beach. And I think Kyle Tucker needs 3 days on the beach.
Yeah. I love this idea. I don't know if that's really leaning into the mental aspect of it, because as we mentioned, there are some seriously troubling just trends, bat speeds down. Like, everything that you wouldn't want to see in the middle of a season out of nowhere from one of the best hitters in the league is happening.
Ground ball rate, which is why people are
speculating. Yeah, which is why people are speculating about an injury. Now, people were thinking, oh, he had a finger injury on June 1st. Okay, but then why was he awesome for all of June? And now only suddenly now has he been terrible. So I don't know what to make of that. Now, this is another thing. We probably one of the most difficult things about us analyzing and the things that we'll never do. This happens in all sports, but there are guys that are hurt all the time that we just have no clue. Like, that are playing through stuff that we couldn't even imagine, amounts of pain that we cannot fathom. And 95% of the time, players are just sucking it up and dealing with it. And it's up to the player and the team to essentially make that determination of, is this worth it? Is this worth it to communicate? Some players and teams view it as beneficial to make it transparent to the media. Others say, like, no, I don't want to make excuses, and no, this is not good. Oh, if they know that I'm hurting here, maybe they're more likely to pitch me here because I can't do this. This is true, like, in basketball, where it's like, his hand's screwed up, so like, force him to dribble with that one, but like, you don't want them to know that. You know, there's different versions of this that exist, and it's possible that that is what's happening with Kyle Tucker. So far, at no point have they been like, yes, this is the physical ailment that I am dealing with.
Yeah.
Perhaps we get to a point where they just put him on the IL with something in the next couple of days. Sometimes that does happen, where the team accepts, like, this is not being fixed, or it needs to be fixed with a more longer stay that does not involve 3 days on the beach in Cancun. We need to actually fix this. And so maybe that will happen with Kyle Tucker, but otherwise it's kind of just on him and the coaches to figure out how to get him going again.
Who's filling in for him? I think that's an interesting part of the story. If I had told you that Kyle Tucker, supposedly healthy, would not be playing during a 5-game set against the Brewers in August, it would be full panic stations. And yet, there's a level of optimism on the north side because of who is filling those shoes, or at least has tried to fill those shoes the last few days.
Yes. Yeah, so Owen Casey, right, you know, Tucker's, you know, obviously been playing right field. Owen Casey, one of their top prospects, who was a character at the deadline because it was like, are they going to trade him? I mean, if the Cubs were going to make a big move for a pitcher, it was probably going to involve Owen Casey in some form. And there was differing levels of reporting about how willing they were to part with him compared to some of their other top prospects. Owen Casey was a second rounder in the 2020 draft by the San Diego Padres, who was then traded 6 months later, possibly like before he ever essentially met anybody with the Padres, I'm realizing, because of the timing of this. I guess he would have had to go to like Arizona to sign. Yeah, also he was in Canada. That's a good point. I'm not really sure how this worked out. He was a Canadian high school draft pick, but right, drafted in June by the Padres, traded to the Cubs just a few months later in the Yu Darvish deal. So he has always been with the Cubs as a professional, and it has been kind of a slow burn. He's still only 23. He was young for his class when he was drafted. And Owen Casey reached AAA last year, spent the entire season last year in AAA, had big slugging numbers, but was striking out a bunch. But normally when you have a prospect that spends a whole year in AAA, it's like, okay, well, clearly he's going to normally that guy you're expecting to see in the big leagues pretty early on in the next season because of the Cubs outfield situation, because of Kyle Tucker, because PCA becomes a MVP candidate, because they have Hap locked in and Suzuki needs playing time. There was no room for Owen Casey, which made him an obvious trade chip, but also made him great insurance in the case that Kyle Tucker forgets how to play baseball. So now finally, the lane kind of opens up. He is performing better in AAA, so you feel more confident that he can help the big league club. He gets called up recently, just hit his first home run this week. He is a volatile hitter, someone who is going to strike out a lot. You can see him getting exposed, certainly against left-handed pitching. But he has the kind of power to, even if it's just for a couple, you know, games, you know, five-game stretch at a time, he can make a difference. He can make a difference. If he's feeling it before the league adjusts to him, he's someone that can absolutely contribute. Now, is he obviously a better player than Kyle Tucker? No. But this is something that they're able to fall back on. And if the degree to which, like, let's say this Tucker thing is a little bit more prolonged. Let's say Tucker does go on the injured list. How does Casey fit into this roster right now, I think, is going to be really interesting, because it seems like there's going to be at-bats for him coming up. But at the same time, I can still see a scenario where it's like, all right, this is nice, but we're going to need, it's not like we're, you know, giving away at-bats to this kid just to make sure, you know, if Tucker's still struggling. Suzuki obviously still in that DH role now that everybody's healthy. There's only so many at-bats to go around. So if anything the Casey can give them right now, the fans are going to appreciate him forever. But if this Tucker thing does become a prolonged thing, if he is actually injured, Casey certainly becomes a lot more important.
Let's take a quick break. When we get back, you're going to hear more NL Central chatter, but not about the Cubs. About the Milwaukee Brewers. We are absolutely honored and amped to have on Brian Anderson, the broadcaster for the Milwaukee Brewers and the AL and NLCS, like all the time. He is one of the best broadcasters alive, but we are going to focus our conversation on those magic Milwaukee Brewers who play the Cubs today for their fourth game of a five-game set. So enjoy this break, and when we get back, it'll be us and BA.
Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. What a treat it is to be joined by one of our favorite voices in the game. And if you're watching on YouTube, you get to see his lovely face as well. It's Brian Anderson, broadcaster for the Milwaukee Brewers and many other things. But Brian, we're going to talk about the Milwaukee Brewers today. Welcome to Baseball Barbacast.
Oh, man. What an honor to be here. Can't wait to get this started.
When did you first start to get recognized for your voice? Like how, when in your career did that happen? No, get out of here. Get out of here. Like in Milwaukee, if you walk in somewhere and you like order a coffee, is the barista ever like,
No, here's the actual interaction that happens most often. Oh, you sound like the guy from the Brewers. Yeah, I'm Brian Anderson. Oh, you seem so much taller on television.
Ooh.
Short Kings, man.
They say that about Caleb Durbin, too.
That's right. Yeah, I am the president of the Short Kings Brewers, who are dominating Major League Baseball. No, that's true. I think the CC Sabathia years that was when kind of, you know, I used to get called Matt Mascurgia a lot because he was the announcer in Milwaukee. Two announcers prior to me, it was Matt Mascurgia and Darren Sutton, and then me. So I still get things shouted at me like, hey, Craig Kishon, or hey, Matt Baskerzin. So it's all good.
Well, here's the thing. Here's the thing, Brian. You have been doing this in Milwaukee for a long time, and yeah. I think you are qualified, not just because it is still your job and you get to call Brewers games all the time, but you have seen this Brewers experience in several different iterations. If I'm not mistaken, your first season there was 2007. Is that yep. correct?
That's right.
Okay. So, and you know, since 2007, the Brewers have been one of the most successful teams in Major League Baseball, at least in the regular season. We know that in the postseason, it has not been quite as successful, but you have seen a lot of very, very compelling, fun, a lot of wins in the regular season. That has happened many times before. But this season feels a little bit different. And we have no idea what's going to happen in October. But as someone who has watched many runs to the playoffs for Milwaukee, what does feel meaningfully different about this run?
Yeah, it's a great question. I've been asked that a lot about, you know, this is my 19th year with the Brewers. And prior to that, I was with the San Antonio Spurs. So I've been really lucky to have been a part of, you know, winning franchises. The Spurs won four titles, four of their five, while I was there as their sideline reporter and working in that organization. Then I came to the Brewers, and pretty much every year I've been here since 07, they have been competitive. So it's usually come down to September, even the years they didn't make it, the Ken Maka years as manager, they were still competitive in September. They were still in a pennant race. But this team, I've never seen anything like this team. I don't know what the postseason's going to look like. That is to be determined. You know, there are a lot of guys on this team that haven't been in a postseason scenario. You know, I think they're going to be good, but it's all about who gets hot. So I want to keep that capsule in the regular season, but I've never seen anything like this from a Brewers team. Even the CC Sabathia run that I mentioned a moment ago, there was a lot of stress in that season. That was my second year. And, you know, those who know the Brewers well know that they weren't even in the postseason until the very last day. They had a chance at a tiebreaker, but only because the Mets collapsed did the Brewers even make it in that year. So as a wild card, this is the old format when the wild card went into a division series. So yes, Sabathia was amazing and revisionist history and all of that. That should be a documentary, but that wasn't special like this. I mean, they just won 40 out of 50 games, and it's been an amazing ride to see with a, you know, the land of the misfit toys and guys that nobody really knew. Certainly we had to do our homework as the local broadcasters, figuring out who these players are, how they fit. What most of them are platoon type players, but you know, they
which
just
one
on
of
everybody.
Them is Isaac Collins,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, he's the one at third base one? Today or second base. Oh, he's going to be maybe the rookie of the year is the left fielder. I don't think that was on the so bingo good. Card at spring training.
Oh, it's so like it's 10, so good, 10 different absurd rookie seasons to kind of sort through, I would say. Like for all different reasons, from Mizorowski to Durbin to Collins to Henderson to Chad Patrick's. It's like on and on and on. You just don't know what's happening. And then, oh, here's Andrew Vaughn. It's Barry Bonds. All right, great. Now we have this. You say, Brian, I haven't seen this. And you can refer to just like the winning speaks for itself, the record, the stretch over these last couple months. But when you say this, what are we talking? Is it just the combinations of the players? Is it the fact that these players had low expectations and low track records? Is it just Pat Murphy? Is it, we are obviously going to ask you about Bob Uecker and just what he has meant, of course, posthumously to this season and what he already meant so much to this city. Give us a little bit more specifics about what this means.
Yeah, there's definitely the Uecker magic part of this. There's no question. I mean, I think that's you know, from a spiritual standpoint, he's always with us and he's going to always be a big part of Brewers baseball. He was the spine of Brewers baseball for so many years. So there is that piece, but that's also the galvanizing piece as well. And a lot of these players didn't know him that well, but they knew him well enough because Uke was always in the clubhouse. So even the younger players, I remember Vin Scully at the end of his career, you know, just wasn't in the best health to go down to the clubhouse. He didn't go downstairs very often. So the players, while they heard Vin Scully, didn't know Vin Scully. That was not the case with Bob Uecker, he had a locker in the clubhouse. Like, he was down there every single day. So that piece still exists in a significant way. Yeah. I would say I think the biggest part of this, and that's a really good question, Jordan, because what I feel and what I mean by that specifically is it's all of those things you mentioned and more. And I think big picture, if you want to pull out a little bit further, I think the Brewers are changing the game. So there are teams that have changed the game. Obviously, players in the NBA, Stephen Curry changed the game, the three-point revolution. I think the Brewers, and I don't know if it's going to carry on to the rest of baseball, it will certainly be the case in Milwaukee, because this is going to have to be how they play and perform and build rosters. But they're bringing baseball back the way I know it. And that means playing to win, playing to compete in every at-bat. And it gets a little touchy, and the analytics crowd comes at me a little bit, because I'm not saying analytics don't have a place. They do. Building rosters, putting the players together that fit or they think can fit, the versatility, all of that plays. But once you get in the room, then it's about the heartbeats and how can you get the most out of those players. So Pat Murphy, coaching staff, very good at that. Players are very good at that. The veteran guys, the Rhys Hoskins, Christian Yelich, you know, 30 years ago, you were a rookie into a clubhouse, you felt like you were unwanted. You were unwelcome. That's not the case now. And I think those guys deserve a lot of that credit. So there's a style of play. It's not incentivized yet financially, but you got to remember the makeup of the Brewers are players who are trying to stay in the big leagues. So that's the incentive. So players who are trying to stay in the big leagues, that is the incentive to play this way. And that is doing all those little things that make baseball great. As I said, I think the Brewers are hopefully going to be the team that breaks the three true outcomes era of Major League Baseball. And I know that's going to be the case in Milwaukee, and that's going to be how they function moving forward. And I do think that it does play. Now, we'll see how it plays in the playoffs, because a team that plays hard and plays to win every at-bat and every sequence, that you lose that edge in the postseason, because every 100% team does that. And so that's my, you know, my biggest concern.
The marketed efficiency, in a way, here is giving a crap all the time.
Yes.
Right. And I think that you are right. That is a concern for how it translates to the playoffs. And we can talk about that in a second. But you bring up the point of analytics. And I think this is what is so fascinating to me about the Brewers on a big picture scale. These are not, this is not an old school organization, right? Like,
no.
Matt Arnold and before him, David Stearns, like, there is a big computer program in Brewers headquarters, literally called The Keg, by the way, which is like the best. That it's the best model. It is a great model, and it helps them do a lot of things on the analytics side. And then they have like maybe the most old school coach manager running the show. And I think what is beautiful about what they do is it is a melding of these two things, right? And what inspires me about it, and you touch on this, is like, they are showing that style of ball in this era can work and lead to wins.
Yes.
Right?
Great point. I mean, that's it.
Yeah.
And so this is a very analytic-driven team. It has been under David Stearns, under Matt Arnold. Matt Arnold came from the Tampa Bay Rays. Obviously, there's a lot of DNA, and that still functions. That's still the way it is. I mean, there's a row of employees that are all into the computers and the analytics and part of the baseball ops and serve very important roles here. I think where the scales tipped was the hiring of Pat Murphy, sensing that, all right, we kind of have our Casey Stengel. You know, this is an older Casey Stengel version of a manager who's kind of old school, has this college background, really good with young players, lifts up players, holds players accountable, but also can take a lot of the spotlight, a lot of the media responsibilities.
Yes.
Can hit on the entertainment piece that, like, ultimately, I talk to Matt Arnold about this all the time, by the way. We just had this conversation on the bus down from Milwaukee to Chicago. And we are in the entertainment industry. That's what needs to probably be pulled back. And the game was getting choked out for a while, and it became tedious. So much so, Major League Baseball set up rules to try to squeeze out some of the tedious nature of it. Well, I think the Brewers, their philosophy, and in an analytics mind, you're always looking for the margins. And I think Matt Arnold and his staff found that. And where are the areas we can thrive that others aren't even exploring? And that is with a payroll that's smaller, with players that are, you know, unheard of or not known yet, older players as they go, they go after these athletes, guys who have played multiple sports. So you see the pattern that's developing. That's where analytics comes in. But once they get into the room, Matt Arnold, probably more than any other analytics-minded general manager, has empowered his manager and his coaches,
yeah,
and even his veteran players to run the clubhouse and,
yeah,
perform in that way. And I think that's what's great, because the game doesn't get artistic and beautiful until the ball's in play. So again, like the three true outcomes, the ball wasn't in play much. It just, yes, we love homers and strikeouts and even walks at time creating base runners, but it wasn't a pretty game for a while. And the way the Brewers play is very entertaining because you have athleticism, balls in play. I don't know how that's going to translate into the postseason, but I think all of that is in the discussion on how can we, yeah, be different as an organization. So yeah, to your, yeah, point, that's why an analytics combo with the old school teaching works, I think.
Yeah. Murphy as the character is just so singular in today's game. And as someone, you know, I'm 29, Jordan's 30. We were not in clubhouses and in manager meetings in the era where it was more, there were like 12 Pat Murphys or 18 Pat Murphys, right? Where you would walk in and this is the thing that really strikes me. You walk into the room, he introduces himself to every single person in the, yeah, room that he doesn't know every single day. Now, yeah, part of it, obviously, is he's performing a little bit. He knows he's funny. He knows that we know that he's funny, right? And like, but it is a singular experience of watching Pat Murphy operate like the soapbox of building up his team, putting down his players, mm-hmm, in public more than any other manager in the big leagues.
Yeah, so build I guess up my in question, private, put down in public. That's
put
it.
Down you in public. Them. Like, it's a fascinating approach. So I guess, you know, I know he's been around. He's been on the staff since 2015. I guess my question for you is, how have you seen Pat Murphy change over that time? How does Pat Murphy 2015 different than Pat Murphy 2022 versus Pat Murphy the manager 2025?
Yeah, I mean, that's he talks about his changes. Obviously, he's in charge now. So as the, yeah, bench coach, he was the stirrer-upper guy. And he was also in that same role for Craig Counsell. So I would say the genius of Craig Counsell, knowing that Pat Murphy in a very serious clubhouse with a serious manager in Craig Counsell, a serious coaching staff, needed somebody like Pat Murphy. So all those years ago, he brought in Murph to be his bench coach. So that he deserves a lot of that credit. And Murph played that role to a T. Now Murph is in charge. And he wasn't in those big league clubhouses as a player. So he's not that guy. He's not the guy who has all this major league pedigree and can call back to the 70s or the 80s during his playing days. That's not what he has. So that he has a great respect for major league players, and that's where it starts. I think if you're a 25-year-old major league player on the Brewers, Pat Murphy will give you the fact that you've accomplished something that he didn't, and that's honorable. And I think right away that sets the, yeah, playing field. But then he also says, but also I'm an observer of humanity and especially baseball, yeah, playing humanity. And I'm going to crack you when you are, you know, have you heard about the checks? The checks?
Oh, game? Yeah. The check game.
So, yeah, you probably know all about that. So we all are part of the check game. I've been checked before. So everybody, if you do something that is egregious or you feel like it's a me first thing, you get a check and he'll call it out in the middle of the clubhouse. And it's a very effective yet funny way to operate. And so there are changes. He'd be the first to tell you he's a different person post heart issue than he was prior to his heart attack. He knows his time is probably short, relatively speaking. I don't know what that, you know, runway is going to be, but he knows he's 66 years old, going on 67, and he knows his time as a manager and in baseball is shorter than most, certainly shorter than a Craig Counsell. So there's all of that perspective. And he's just like your favorite uncle at the barbecue, who also can just fillet you and get a big laugh, but also a little bit of shame in there that kind of keeps everybody galvanized. And he's also the one that I think the players come around, that's our guy. But
yeah,
they can rally around it. It's the opposite of, say, the Bobby Knight syndrome, where Bobby Knight, his whole philosophy was, I'm going to have my team all hate me the same so they can be at least be aligned on their hating of me. Murph's kind of the opposite of that.
Yeah, yeah. It reminds me, I don't know how much you watch like European soccer.
Yeah, a little bit.
It is the main characters on any given team are way more often the manager.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the comparison in the States is like college sports, where it's like the job of the head person is to take the heat from the media off of the players. And a lot of that at times comes with singing and dancing. Like, oh, Murphy pulling the pocket pancake out. Like, that's a calculated but genuine choice, right? Like, that's not just, like, he's thinking about what he's doing. Jordan, I'll kick it to you.
So I want to finish with Yelich. I want to get back on the field. But something that I was not planning to ask you about, but just talking about Murph, that I really feel like I've not seen talked about much or read anything about, is Ricky Weeks.
Yeah, dude.
I am fascinated by, like, this is someone who, of course, you watched his, I mean, I guess you weren't there at the very, very beginning of his career. But still, I mean, you saw Ricky Weeks as a player for a long time in Milwaukee. And I'm just curious where he kind of fits into this equation as this associate manager, what your sense is his persona within the clubhouse? How has this become a passion for him to get into coaching? And, you know, just because, again, he's associate manager, there's not that many of those around the league. And for it to be him who has this great history as a player in Milwaukee, what your experiences with her as a player, if it's something you thought he was going to do someday, I'd love to ask about him because he's just not someone I've ever heard kind of talk.
See, this is why you guys who you are. Nobody asked me about Ricky Weeks. But he is such a part of the secret sauce.
Okay, yeah, I'm glad. And by the way, we can talk about Ricky Weeks, the player.
Absolute bullseye, Jordan, that you asked about Ricky Weeks.
Ricky Weeks, the player, is also something we could talk about for 2 hours. Oh, but let's
one of my all-time favorites.
There's a great legend.
Maybe you could post this later, but my favorite image, and it hung on the walls of the clubhouse for years, was Ricky Weeks taking a fastball to the jaw and not going down and not going out of the game. To the jaw.
Dude.
And there's a famous picture Scott Paulus took, our photographer, of the impact of that baseball in his jaw. And that is the epitome of Ricky Weeks. He's one of my all-time favorite Brewers. I call him the Prince Fielder Whisperer. He was the only guy that could speak properly to Prince Fielder. You know, they go way back to their preteen days. They were in Orlando. And Ricky is just, not only is he a great dad, husband, family man, all of that, but man, he's as tough and no nonsense as it gets. He's got an incredible legacy of his family legacy. His grandfather was in the Negro League circle as a player. He has that DNA. Old school DNA, tough, but also similar to Murph, just not as vocal, but similar. He can crack a player like that. And sometimes it's with force, sometimes it's just with an arm around you. And I think that is very intentional by Pat Murphy to put Ricky Weeks in that spot. That was, you know, I asked Murph about that when he got the managerial job. If you remember, Pat Murphy's initial press conference introducing him as the manager, he had Ricky Weeks right next to him.
Yeah.
And right, that was not, right. I was like, wow, why is Matt Arnold making Pat Murphy's moment of truth in his whole life? Why is he having Ricky Weeks join him? And I asked Pat, well, that was a little odd. And he goes, no, I demanded that. Murph did. And because Pat, I think he looked at the coaching staff, he knew he's got a ton of workers and great talented builder-upper teachers of players, all of that. But what he didn't have was a guy who had been a star. And
yeah.
Teams are still
there's not a lot of those on coaching staffs in general.
No, because they've all made so much money, and Ricky made a ton of money. He doesn't need to do this, but he loves the game. He's a dirtbag. He loves baseball. And so I think Murph looked around, and Ricky was in the Brewer system kind of sporadically popping in and out as a special assistant, but really enjoying it. And the reports were from players that he had had an impact on were, man, Ricky Weeks kind of like made this go for me. So that was starting to be a common thing, very similar to Charlie Green in the bullpen when, you know, he was a catching instructor coming up, and similar to Chris Hook as a pitching coach in the minor leagues, then a coordinator, similar to Rick Sweet, who's the AAA manager. So these were very common things that were surfacing up in the big leagues, like who had an impact? Oh, Ricky Weeks. Jace Peterson is in that role right now, by the way, if you want to put a pin in one. Jace Peterson is doing that role and having an impact. Carlos Villanueva is another guy. So Ricky has been this guy that is calm, but also has this like burn in him, and you know it. And he's good for Murph, and he's great for players, and he's especially great for star players. So, namely Christian Yelich, and namely guys like William Contreras.
Perfect transition. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. So, well, last thing on Ricky, that insight is awesome. When StatCast came out with the bat speed metric, I was like, oh, if only we had this for Ricky Weeks. Oh man, it would be so good. Rake. Like that's the guy.
It's
like
no,
I don't. Like I don't need the Barry Bonds exit velos. I mean, I do, but I need the Ricky Weeks bat speed.
I need fastball in on the hands. Ricky
this
Weeks
dude
pulls
didn't get it by him, man.
Oh my goodness, what a special hitter. Okay, all right, let's get to Christian Yelich. Let's finish with him.
Yeah. Well, I have one more question before you do, Yelich. I just want to know about the city of Milwaukee vis-a-vis the Brewers, because the Brewers fan base fascinates me. Because the amount of playoff success or lack thereof that they have had versus the amount of interest that the fan base has in the team and the media market size is unlike anything else in baseball, right?
Yeah.
And there's this embedded like, oh, well, we're just going to lose in the playoffs again. That is also, wow, it's so nice outside in the summer. Let's sit in the parking lot and have a bunch of brats, my apologies.
There you go.
And enjoy the Brewers, right? It is such a unique, like, fan ideology. And I know you're not originally from Wisconsin, but can you kind of speak to what makes that so different? Because as someone who has not really been around it, I struggle to, like, put my finger on it exactly, but I just sense that there's this thing emanating from Brewers land that feels very unique.
Yeah. I mean, I love it here, and I love it for that reason. Again, 19 years. The first call I got when I got the job was from Ernie Harwell, which was the coolest thing ever. But he told me something. He said, you're going to love Milwaukee, and there's nothing like the Midwest sports fan, especially in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. This is Ernie Harwell, who, you know, Hall of Fame voice of the Tigers in the American League. Brewers used to be in the American League. He obviously had an affinity for Milwaukee. And that just kind of rattled me because I wasn't sure what I was getting into. But there is it was very similar in San Antonio. San Antonio thrived on the underdog ideology. And Milwaukee is that, you know, it's that. Socially, it's that from a civic perspective with Chicago so close, kind of always, you know, the little brother, the little sister. And I think that resonates, and that's a galvanizing piece too. And so when the Brewers, and you compartmentalize it into a regular season fun and entertainment versus like what happens in the postseason. Now, the Packers have had great success, and that's a different kind of thing. There's a great expectation typically that the Packers are going to be good, are going to perform. And if they win Super Bowls, it's a great moment, but also in a small way expected.
And
they've had great players. I contend, and we'll find out, if the Brewers win the World Series, for the city of Milwaukee especially, it would be a bigger victory for the fans than the Packers for the state of Wisconsin, because the Brewers are Milwaukee's team. All throughout Wisconsin as well, but there is that piece to it, and there's this, you know, it's a city of festivals, so there's a festival in the summertime atmosphere. You've got Summerfest, you've got the State Fair. You have these gathering places, these public spaces, and the Brewers are totally central to that in the summer. You also have a roof, so you know you're going to play. So now you have these massive crowds, which feels like a college football Saturday, four or five times a week. Could be a Wednesday afternoon, and the parking lot's full of shanties and cornhole and beers and brats. And that's a real thing. And that shocked me when I first got here. So it's a beautiful thing. And the 82 team, still the 80s. So, you know, your childhood, those who have moved on from Wisconsin still refer back. And those are your core memories. And, you know, I think that still plays with all of this. There's great history, but there's not great history of like winning. There's no World Series wins. But that's like, there are guys, there are teams that came up just short, and we're going to rally up with them. And that exists in a big way.
Like, I live in DC now. I just spent 8 years in New York being around the Yankees, and like the Yankees, so often history feels like a backpack of rocks where it weighs on them all the time. And in this way, it almost like elevates the fan base, at least during the regular season. And just quickly to speak about Milwaukee, I saw Bon Iver at Summerfest a couple years ago. And it was my first time in the city. And oh my goodness gracious. For all of our listeners who have never been to Milwaukee in the summertime, it is sublime.
Me.
Jordan.
Oh, it's not just listener,
top
co-host.
Five city.
Dude, I've been trying to get there. And that's why I'm, you know, very objectively rooting for the Brewers. to get there finally forced me to get to Milwaukee. I mean, I live in the Midwest. I should make it happen. But you mentioned, right, like that building it up, not just the regular season. And obviously there's a lot of pride, but when you go to the postseason 6 of 7 years and you know, you feel like you're always there, but it's not always quite getting close enough, that it only builds, I imagine.
Yeah.
The wanting and the just the anticipation of to have a team like this or the possibility to go farther. So
well, the case study is, and we saw this in Chicago in 16, the case study is if the Brewers win a World Series, what then? Because the journey of it and the angst of it and the hand wringing.
Totally.
Yes.
Those are the pieces that really, that's the glue. That's what kind of brings it all together. So,
and there's a couple teams like that you could say
Red Sox fandom,
San Diego. Yep. Like, I've wondered that too, for sure.
Red Sox fandom and Cubs fandom is less interesting now to me.
I'm with you.
I'm not saying that those teams shouldn't have won for the sake of the joy.
It's not like those fans still don't care a lot. It's just different.
Yeah, it's just different.
It's just a different thing.
Long-suffering fan.
Exactly.
We love the long-suffering fans.
Jordan's in Cleveland.
There's pride. Oh, my God. Cleveland. Oh, my goodness. Let me tell you.
How great was the postseason Cleveland last year? Like, dude. I had the same conversation about Milwaukee. I saw you there,
B.A. We were – yes.
Yes. I mean, that's how – there's a great connection. Tom Hamilton and I, he's a Wisconsin guy anyway. Totally. So what you guys are hitting on right now, we talk about that all the time. Broadcasters do, because the storytelling part of this, the tavern of the game that we do every day, you know, we're like literally talking to a bar full of 50 people in the middle of a broadcast. And there's this charm, and I actually love that about it. So I would love to see the Brewers win a World Series. Don't get me wrong. It would be amazing to see that happen. I would be very interested to see what would happen after. Again, back to San Antonio, they were always the underdogs. Phil Jackson put an asterisk on them for their championship in 99. But when they ripped off 5 and had this amazing era, you know, things kind of changed a little bit in San Antonio. Yeah, there was an expectation level. Now all of a sudden the Spurs rebuild and it's half full in the arena. And it's like, whoa,
right.
Now we got to win championships now to appease a fan base. So it's a real interesting dynamic that's going on.
We are, as people who just for some reason decided to become Buffalo Sabres fans, I think we can understand that is the kind of fandom that we are attracted to. We've gone really long with you, BA, but this has been so much fun. I do want to finish. We can keep it brief, but Christian Yelich is also a character on this Brewers team for this franchise that obviously means a lot. Someone who comes over in this trade in Miami, and I'm sure at that point he's like, all right, let's see what this is, this new place. Who knows what I'm going to become here? And then obviously obviously what the player he is immediately for them, signs this huge extension, and now he's the guy, right? He's the superstar. We've seen his career kind of go some ups and downs, but now back to being kind of at a star level performer. How have you seen his kind of evolution since arriving as this skinny kid from the Marlins to being the guy? He's the face of the Brewers right now.
He definitely is, and I think every young player who comes to the big leagues, these guys who are experiencing Major League Baseball for the first time or first, second, third year players, they owe Christian Yelich a debt of gratitude because you could not have a better veteran guy face a franchise type. He hates that frame, and they asked us not to do that, but he is. And he is the big name, the guy who takes on the weight of it all, but he's a chill Southern Californian. He's very respectful. He's very aware. He knows guys who need the pickup. He knows guys who needs their balls busted. Like he's kind of the perfect guy for this market, and he's thrived here, and he loves Milwaukee. And he had two amazing years, signed the contract. The injuries started to play, but good for him that the back surgery, that's risky. That was a big decision. Yeah. His career could have ended. You know, back surgeries aren't guarantees. He had the back surgery. He's kind of transferred into predominantly a designated hitter, which I think has extended him. And, that, you know, I talked to him the other day, and he said he feels like he feels so good now that he thinks he could do another contract. And meaning he feels like he could keep playing. And you would not have been able to say that 2 and 3 years ago because of the pain and the way he has to prepare for a game. Just to be on the field. And so, you know, I give him a ton of credit. I think he's been rejuvenated. He loves being in that. I think he finds it odd that he's in this leadership role. He doesn't think of himself as a 30s type player. But he is. And I think he knows that. So you can watch him catch himself walking through the clubhouse where in the early days he was under that Ryan Braun, you know, that group. And he could just kind of slip into his locker and not be seen if he didn't want to. And I think you see him catch himself now like, oh, I need to be the one that speaks about things that are happening, good or bad, like the big drama and the bad drama. He's kind of the one that takes on that weight. And I think he's a major piece. He's a huge chapter. If you did a documentary on this team, he's a huge chapter because he's been great. He's got a chance to go 30 and 100 this year.
Well, this is the thing. And like, if you look at, I'm just going to be very simple here, OPS plus since 2023, 28th in baseball, above Pete Alonso, Alex Bregman, Francisco Lindor, Byron Buxton. Like, he's not an MVP candidate, both because the offense has taken a half step back and he's not playing the outfield, but like, he bangs, man. Yeah. He's really good.
Yeah, he bangs and he resonates when he's man. Not at the play. It's a hard thing to go from an athletic gold glove, everyday good player point. Who plays the outfield to then be a DH. You don't see yourself as that. You know, athletes,
they don't
see themselves in that role. But he's stealing bases. Watching him go first to third still as beautiful as ever. He's got those long strides. He's very fast. That's all measurable now. And you can see he's running better than he has in the last few years. He's obviously kind of back to a borderline all-star level, but he's the guy that against the better pitchers too, you know, in the big situations, I would say he and Brandon Woodruff are the two guys that are setting the tone for what you can be as a group. And the Brewers need that. You know, they're not the Dodgers. They're not the Cubs even with all these veteran players, these all-stars who all kind of pick up their own piece of that. You know, I think Yelich is the one. And give Rhys Hoskins some credit. And certainly Contreras has been a great player. But, you know, mostly Yelich is the guy that is he's kind of the center spine of this team.
Yeah. Well, BA, thank you so much for spending some time with us and for, you know, Brewers splaining both us and our listeners. It really is just such a fascinating, invigorate. Like the Brewers, as someone who grew up on the East Coast, like I feel invigorated, and my relationship with baseball has improved because of the 2025 Brewers. And I hope that is the case for the people listening to the show. BA, where can people listen to you talk about anything, man. Really?
Every day. I feel like every day gets sick of my voice. TBS Tuesdays, obviously. That's ratcheting up now. We'll be in the postseason for TBS. Nice. We have the National League on TBS this year. So every matchup in the National League is going to be epic. I've done the Brewers twice in the postseason. That's always a little awkward, but no big deal.
Now you're a pro, though. You are a professional. You are a national broadcaster. I am confident that if you were calling Brewers games, that people will still enjoy them, even if they are not from Milwaukee.
Well, we got to do it. Yeah, Brian it's going to be great. We're looking forward to it. You guys are awesome, man. I appreciate all you do for the game too. Always good to be with you.
Just stop. It's very kind. Thank you for so much of your time. Again, it's been awesome to get to know you over the last few years. It is a true privilege, and hope to see you in the postseason in some Midwestern city, ideally.
But we'll hold you to that. Let's go.
We will see. We will see. So thank you, VA. Enjoy the rest of the season. We'll talk to you soon, my friend.
All right, guys. Thanks.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Before we go any further, there's something that we need to talk about. The standings at this time of the year are so funny because I'm not watching bad teams when they play other bad teams. I don't have the emotional energy for that. And so teams can just like fly up the standings without really noticing. And this is happening with the Kansas City Royals, who all of a sudden are 2.5 games back of a playoff spot. They have won 5 in a row. They are 4 games over 500. Meanwhile, the Boston Red Sox and Seattle Mariners are tumbling down the standings. The Yankees have passed both of those clubs. And the Royals, this morning, August 20th, have playoff odds at 24%. What in the world?
So the Royals have leapfrogged the two Ohio representatives in the respective wildcard races. It looked like about a week ago, it's going to be basically Ohio versus New York, right? We had the Mets and Yankees in free fall. We had the Guardians and Reds kind of surging up the standings. That has changed a little bit over the last week. And now here the Royals are, as you mentioned, they have worked their way back up finally to an even 0 run differential. They have scored 480 runs. They have allowed 480 runs. And this is a big deal because this team, it's like we're starting the season over right here, but they are 4 games over 500, as you mentioned. You know, 9 back of Detroit, so we're not talking about the division. But listen, the same 6 teams in both leagues have been in postseason position for basically a month plus now. They've just been shuffling the order. And even though the Rays have gotten up there within a half game, the Rangers at one point tied Texas, the Reds have always been like a game or a game and a half. It's been the same teams for, I think, since July 11th was the last time we had a different team. Tampa was in one of those spots by themselves. It would be nice to, now as much as I'm looking forward to watching the current playoff structure as it looks, because it's a lot of compelling teams, do we have one more twist here in September? History tells us yes. History tells us that we should not get too comfortable with what the standings look like, and that with that third wild card dangling for a team like Kansas City, who has, again, we kind of smirked when it's like, all right, great, Mike Yastrzemski, Randall Grichuk, Adam Frazier, very, very impressive deadline. But okay, Ryan Burkert, that's a nice little move to kind of address the pitching staff. And Mike Yastrzemski is at 5 home runs already. And so obviously, we saw the Royals make the postseason last year. I was skeptical they could do it again for a lot of the reasons that have absolutely been borne out, which is that the bottom of their lineup has stunk for much of the year, and the pitching has not been at the very, very top of the league the way that it was last season. It's been merely pretty good. So a lot of that regression has occurred, but they've managed to be just good enough to find time to get hot and to get to a situation where you can squint and be like, you know what? If the Red Sox and Mariners want to absolutely bungle this, then maybe there is a chance for Kansas City.
What's gone well? Yastrzemski, since the being acquired, has been absolutely on fire. You've got great pitching performances, like you said, from Burgert and Cameron and Michael Wacha.
Yeah.
And then the thing about the Royals, and I'm not trying to like oversimplify, like they have Bobby Witt Jr., who's a, when he's cooking, like a top five player in the world. And so he's starting to heat back up. Big home run last night. He's just capable of doing things that other players can't do. But yes, like you mentioned, what I am hoping for is just another character to enter the ring so that we can have some sort of narrative, you know, narrative juice here down the stretch in the wild card race. Because right now, like, it just feels pretty set unless the Royals poke their heads in the mix.
So we'll see. Thank you, Royals, for grabbing our attention.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. Reds, Guardians, there's still a chance. Rangers, I'm not loving what I'm seeing there. but hey, plenty of time left. We still got about, you know, 35, 40 games left. Let's have some fun, Kansas City. All right. Let's get to our next segment. One of our favorites, but oh boy, this is a real tough one. Jake Mintz, we have a new edition of That Can't Happen. And this one hurts. This is almost one of the more cruel ones I've seen in a while. Not from your perspective, but from the mistake that was made. Tell us what Mr. Andy Martino did online.
Andy Martino, Mets reporter at SNY, friend of the program. Really like Andy. Good cat, good dude. Yep. Had many nice conversations with him over the years. I like him quite a bit.
Yeah. He's reported a lot. He's generally pretty good at his job. Yeah.
Does a good job. I don't think he is particularly mistake oriented, right? Like I think he does a good job. However, the other day, after news of Francisco Alvarez hurting his thumb in the Williamsport game, Martino tweeted, "Awaiting details from Mets on Francisco Lindor's injury, but there is at least concern that he could be lost for the season." Understandably, this led to just panic stations in Mets land because Lindor's been like really healthy this year. No reports of an injury. Martino is a very valid source, right? Who gets things right a lot. And so,
that's the problem. That's the real issue.
He's too good at his job for this to happen.
Well, it's not that. It's that he has enough credibility to where you wonder, wait a minute, does Andy know something nobody else does? Which happens all the time. Like, Andy's breaking news all the time. And so he's plugged in. There are many times when Andy tweets something about the Mets that no one else has, not even just like, oh, here's a trade that happened, but like, he knows what's going on with the team. And so when you see this, and again, it'd be one thing if he just tweeted "awaiting details for Mets on Francisco Lindor's injury" and tweet, that's bad. But to then have there's concern he's lost for the season as part of this mistake, that's where it just goes all the way over the line into an inexcusable mistake that is, unfortunately for non-Mets fans, extremely funny and why we're talking about it on the podcast. But yeah, I mean, come on, Andy. That's just hopefully less than there.
For me, it is just the perfect example of that cannot happen, right? Like, if you're going to mix up, you know what would be worse than this, actually? The only thing that would be worse than this? Mm. Arm injury for Juan Soto, but it's really Gregory Soto. Like, Soto on IL with arm issue.
Well, I mean, Juan Soto has had arm issues, so maybe, yeah, that would be a little spooky. But no, I don't know. I actually think this is basically like the worst.
This is worse.
Francisco Lindor out for the season. Like, any notion of that is just...
Especially because last year down the stretch... Wow. We had like Francisco Lindor back problems maybe after the season.
Right. I actually forgot about that. And then he obviously turned out to be just fine in October.
The Mets are in DC right now. Oof.
Yeah.
The Mets are in DC right now. And like Soto Juan is like walking back towards the dugout. And one of the things about Nats Park that's unique and maybe not the best way, at least selfishly for our job, is that the fans during BP are so close to the dugout, like right there.
Yes.
And so it just creates this like very hectic situation. So Soto walks by And everyone's like, Soto, Soto, Soto. And I was like, where is Gregory?
Where is he? Yeah, they actually acquired Gregory Soto just to like create more body double there. That was the whole point. I like that. All right. We have one more segment, Jake, on this Wednesday edition. Let's go around the league.
The Biebs is back, baby. Swag.
The Biebs is back. We have two big topics. One is happier than the others for around the league. Shane Bieber is coming back on Friday. A lengthy journey that has eventually landed on him pitching on August 22nd, 2025 for the Toronto Blue Jays, which is probably not what he necessarily envisioned when he re-signed with the Cleveland Guardians in the offseason, when he was rehabbing with the Cleveland Guardians all summer and looked like he was about to come back and then had a brief setback. And so then he had to take a month off of throwing, and then he came back and was rehabbing all the way up to AAA right before the deadline. And he looks good in the minor leagues, good enough with the Guardians in shambles due to their gambling other pitchers. And also just not playing very well, they decided, you know what, we're going to trade Shane Bieber because Cal Steven is a good pitching prospect and the Blue Jays need him more than we do right now. So, Shane, we love you. We would have loved to have you come back and pitch for us again. But instead, his lengthy tenure in the organization concludes with a trade to Toronto, where he joins a Blue Jays pitching staff that, I mean, just the number of innings that this Blue Jays pitching staff has and like service time in their career is a pretty remarkable group of pitchers.
Oh, yeah.
Where dude. Shane Bieber, coming from Cleveland, you know, he had almost become the old guy. And now he is the youngest pitcher on the staff. We'll see how it shakes out with, you know, is Eric Lauer stay in the rotation in some form, whatever. But with Berríos, with Bassett, with Gausman, with Scherzer, Shane Bieber's now the young guy who's only been in the league, you know, 6-7 years. Whereas, of course, these other guys, just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of innings with these impressive careers. And now Shane Bieber joins a first place Blue Jays team. And just talking to Shane a good amount over the past few months, boy, has he been itch. I mean, this is, of course, true for anybody coming back from surgery, but he's someone that is not, he does not want to be, you know, pitching in the low stakes minor leagues anymore. He has been thinking about competing in the majors for months and months and months, and going through this rehab process, of course, for the first time in his career has been a grind, and now having to adjust to living in a new country has given him like a different challenge over the last few months or last few weeks, I should say, where he's like, yeah, the baseball part, that part's his. I'm not concerned about that. It's, you know, moving my wife and recently born child to Canada for this stretch run with a potential, you know, we don't know with his contract, you know, we assume he's going to pitch well and opt out. We'll see. Maybe he is in Toronto next season. Who knows? But it's quite the midseason adjustment for him. But he's quite excited to be back. I'm excited for how good he looked at the beginning of last season before he went down. Oh. Man, oh, man. It's exciting to see what Bieber can be again for a new team for the first time.
He's going to just start throwing a U in everything. That's the adjustment, man. That and like, ooh, what's, man, it called? Pizza pizza?
Pizza pizza. Yeah, I don't know what, I'll just start saying defense with a C. That's really the main, you know, adjustment he's going to have to make. But Shane Bieber, we are excited to watch you once again. Last bit of news before we say goodbye. We talked about the Victor Robles throwing the bat incident in the minor leagues. We speculated, yeah, he's probably going to get suspended. Not only was he suspended, is a 10-game suspension handed down by Major League Baseball, not Minor League Baseball or Pacific Coast League, a 10-game suspension because it involves an in-game incident. This is not like a drug suspension or anything. That means the Mariners cannot replace his roster spot once they activate him. That is a bad thing for the Seattle Mariners at this stage in the season for a million reasons that are fairly obvious. Whether they choose to activate him before September 1st when rosters expand, or wait till then and then essentially punt on the extra spot for while Robles is out. I don't know how they're going to handle this. The point is the Mariners are kind of going through it right now, and now they have this, something that didn't even happen with their major league team for a player that's been out for a long time. It's incredibly disappointing and concerning, and Robles is appealing, so maybe he could get it shortened a little bit, but this is a huge wrinkle for Seattle's roster construction in the coming weeks.
It also sucks because in order to add him to the roster, someone will need to be removed from the roster unless they do it after rosters expand from 26 to 28. Either way, the idea of someone being removed from the roster, and it's like, hey, we're taking you off the roster, we're DFAing you, we're optioning you for the concept of a guy.
for the potential the clock of to a start person. Ticking so that Victor Robles can play for us in 10 games. So, I don't know, really super messy weird. Thing that not ideal for the Seattle Mariners. But all right, that's it. We're done. We did a podcast. Thank you to Brian Anderson for joining us. Thank you to Andrew Hartson, TJ Brassel for producing. As always, you can email us at baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. And yes, remember, we are now on the Yahoo Sports Network, yahoosports.tv. Make sure you check it out. Until Friday, thank you all for listening. Adios.